This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Genesis. And now here's Pastor Sandy in the book of Genesis, chapters 4 through 6.
I think we all should desire a walk so close to God, so intimate with God, that our hearts become more in tune with heaven than they become in tune with earth. Enoch means dedicated, and he walked so close to God that God decided to do a little rapture practice. And he snatched up Enoch. He desired his fellowship so much, he said, Enoch, come and be with me. And Enoch was not. In fact, Jude chapter 14 explains just how much Enoch knew of God and his plans. He was so intimate with God, he was privy to God's plans. In fact, Jude verse 14 tells us that Enoch was a prophet, and what he prophesied. It says, behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment on all. Isn't this amazing? Enoch was seventh from Adam, but he was already proclaiming the second coming of Jesus Christ. Isn't that interesting? That's how intimate he was with the plans and with the knowledge of God. Well, verse 25, Methuselah lived 187 years and begot Lamech. After he begot Lamech, Methuselah lived 782 years and had sons and daughters. And so all the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died. You've heard the phrase, as old as Methuselah? Well, this man has the oldest recorded age in history. And that becomes more than just an answer to a trivia question. When you realize that his father, Enoch, was a prophet, and that the son, Methuselah, was a prophecy. Methuselah was God's prophetic timepiece. Here's what his name means. When he dies, it will be sent. That's what Methuselah means. When he dies, it will be sent. And guess when Methuselah died? The very year that the flood came. He died the same year that God began to judge the earth with water. And of course, this highlights for us God's patience, God's mercy, God's grace. For when God ties a coming judgment to a particular lifespan, he doesn't choose some guy that lived 30 years or some guy that lived 70 years. No, he chooses a guy who lived 969 years. He chooses the one man who's lived the longest than anybody else. Obviously, God doesn't like judgment, does he? Obviously, God doesn't want to judge the earth. He desires that we repent. He desires that we be saved. That's why he says, when this guy dies, and he lived and lived and lived to be 969 years before judgment came. It's an example of God's mercy, God's patience, and his desire to save. Notice too, there were three groups of people alive at the time of Noah's flood. First of all, there was the wicked. They are the ones that will drown in the deluge. The second group of people are Noah's family. They're the ones that are protected in the midst of the storm. And then there's a third group of people alive at the time of the flood. Enoch. He was the one that God caught up prior to the judgment coming down. He experienced the flood not on the earth but in heaven under God's protection. And note the typology here. For the next time that the earth will be judged by God, at the end of the age, during the great tribulation, there will also be three groups of people represented. There will be the wicked that will be judged in the tribulation. There will be the Jews who, like Noah and his family, are protected by God in the midst of the storm here on the earth. But there's a third group of people, the church, who, like Enoch, will go up before the judgment comes down. And we'll experience that final judgment with Jesus by his side under his protection in heaven. Well, Seth's genealogy continues in verse 28. Lamech lived 182 years and had a son, and he called his name Noah, which means comfort or rest. This one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed. After he begot Noah, Lamech lived 595 years and had sons and daughters. So all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died. And Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begot Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, excluding Enoch, the average age of the men in chapter 5 is 908 years old. And some of these geezers, notice, are still having children after having been alive for several hundred years. I mean, we're told in verse 32 that Noah sired three sons at the age of 500. Guys, it's never too late. Also, they all birthed sons and daughters, multiples. Now, how many kids do you think you could have if you were baby-making for over 500 years? This is why I believe that the earth was as populated before the flood as it is today, maybe even more so. And of course, the question comes up in our minds, how did people live 900 years? Remember in Genesis chapter 1, verse 7, God divided the waters from below the sky from the waters above the sky, above the firmament. And some scholars believe that the water above referred to more than just simple water vapor in the air, in the atmosphere. They believe that before the flood, there was a dense, highly compacted vapor canopy that existed in the upper levels of our atmosphere. The oldest book that's written, the book of Job, seems to speak of this vapor canopy in chapter 38, verse 9. There God says, "When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band." It's interesting that the latest theories on aging point to the sun as the culprit. Theoretically, the human body should be able to rejuvenate itself indefinitely. But around the age of 25, remember back to 25? Around the age of 25, the body starts to deteriorate. Some scientists believe that it's the solar radiation that sends a signal to the DNA that triggers the aging process. But if this canopy shrouded and shielded the earth from much of this harmful radiation, people could have lived much, much longer. The aging process could have been delayed, you know, by hundreds of years. In addition, with this vapor canopy, the antediluvian world would have been a virtual paradise. Global temperatures would have been constantly right around 72 degrees. Storms, even rain, would be non-existent since hot air would never collide with cold air. The world before the flood would have been a tropical paradise. There would have been lush vegetation from pole to pole. The earth would have been a colossal greenhouse in essence. It's interesting that all around the world, there's impressive evidence for this idea. Fossilized palm trees have been found above the Arctic Circle. In Siberia, we found those frozen woolly mammoths with tropical vegetation still in their mouths. Which brings up the question, woolly mammoths, what happened to the dinosaurs? Well, I personally believe that the dinosaurs were among the animals on Noah's Ark. They lived in the antediluvian world, and they were contemporaries of man. We found cave drawings of dinosaurs put there by human artists. In fact, the Bible describes two animals that sound amazingly like dinosaurs. Go home and read Job chapters 40 and 41. There are creatures that many people would call dinosaurs alive on the earth today in remote parts of the world. In 1977, what some people think was a plesiosaur was snagged 900 feet underwater near Christchurch in New Zealand. You can go back on the internet and you can pull up a picture of it. I believe that Noah carried every kind of dinosaur on board the ark. But don't think of adult dinosaurs. He brought aboard babies or even dinosaur eggs. The extinction of the dinosaurs occurred shortly after they exited the ark. This collapsed vapor canopy and the upheaval that the flood caused upon the earth changed the topography, changed the climate, changed the vegetation. and the dinosaurs could no longer survive in the post-flood ecosystem. Well, chapter 6 describes the perversion that I believe led to the destruction of this antediluvian world. It says, "Now it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful. And they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. Now understand, God is omnipotent or all-powerful. God is omniscient or all-knowing. God is omnipresent or all-present. He's present everywhere, but God is not omnipatient. There are limits to God's patience. There are boundaries to his long-suffering. And God issues a countdown here. He says, from this point, there will be 120 days until D-Day, until Judgment Day. And this was the time that Noah needed to build his ark. Let me admit that these verses that we've just read give rise to two different interpretations. Some see, in verse 2, the sons of God as the lineage of Seth, intermarrying with the daughters of men or the family of Cain. They believe that the godly line of Seth compromised and took pagan wives. The only problem with that to me is that it doesn't explain God's motivation for wiping out the whole earth, and it also doesn't fit with the description we get of their offspring in verse 4. For in verse 4 we're told, there were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men and they bore children to them, those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Now, this is why I believe there's more going on here than believers marrying unbelievers. I've seen mixed marriages where believers married unbelievers, and I've seen their offspring. And I've never seen one of their offspring be a giant. Never. In fact, their kids look a lot like my kids. The phrase sons of God is the Hebrew term Bini Elohim. And the phrase appears 4 times in the Old Testament, and each time that it does, it refers to angels. Jude 6 speaks of the angels who, quote, did not keep their proper domain. What does that mean? Well, I believe that the sons of God in Genesis 6 are those angels who did not keep their proper domain. I believe that they were fallen angels, that a perversion of the human race began to take place in the antediluvian world. Fallen angels materialized in human form and began to impregnate human women, producing a distorted race of mutant humanoids. They were freaks of nature. They became common on the earth, these giants. Verse 4 calls them giants, which is a translation of the Hebrew word Nephilim, which means fallen ones. In Genesis chapter 1, we discuss that when Satan couldn't stop the creation of man, he tried to spoil it. And here he attempts to contaminate the human gene pool and engineer the extinction of humanity. And this was why God's judgment was so severe. God destroys the earth with water, not because a few people got out of hand. He wipes out the entire human population, not because of a couple of bars opening up on the corner. And starts over with 8 people. He does it because he knows it's the only way for him to be able to save the human race. It's interesting that in every culture, there are myths of demigods, of beings that were half human and half divine. You've seen them in Greek mythology and in other places. Of course, myths are myths, but some of those stories could have actually been inspired by the events talked about here in Genesis chapter 6. Notice 2 verse 4 says that there were giants in Noah's day, and notice, and afterwards. Later, when the Hebrews spy out the land of Canaan, they report seeing giants in the land. And there the word is the same, Nephilim. Remember, too, David's famous opponent when he went out to fight the Philistines? A man named Goliath who was a giant or a Nephilim. There is a Hebrew tradition. It's spoken of in the extra-biblical book of Enoch, where these fallen angels are the ones who were identified as the ones who taught humanity the evils of black magic and the science of war and weaponry and how to abort unborn babies. It's also interesting that the subject of Genesis chapter 6 is now a favorite Hollywood movie theme. If some of you guys can think back to 1968, the movie Rosemary's Baby, it was based on this concept about demons intermarrying, taking human form and intermarrying with women and giving birth to a baby. More recently, the movie Michael that starred John Travolta. Michael played a lust-filled angel whose main desire was to hit on beautiful women. Hey, this is demonic stuff. This goes back to Genesis chapter 6 and why God judged the earth with a flood. And this is why Jesus says, as in the days of Noah, so it will be in the last days, in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. The parallels are interesting. In the occult, did you know the highest experience possible in the occult is sex with a demon? The offspring is called a moon child. This is the reason that God destroyed the earth with water. This was why his measures were so severe. He was trying to save the human race from this kind of demonic pollution. Well, verse 5 tells us, "Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was on evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth." What a sad statement. "And he was grieved in his heart." Remember, the word grieved is a love word. You know, you can anger anyone, but you can only grieve a person who loves you. God is grieved because he loves us. Verse 7, "So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing, and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them." After the flood, God promises to never again destroy the earth with water, but he doesn't promise not to destroy the earth again. In fact, the Bible predicts that God will bring judgment to the earth a second time. The first time he judged the earth with water, the second time he'll do it with fire. And with the perversions we see in the world today, how can that judgment be far off? But Noah, we're told, found grace in the eyes of the Lord. This is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. Notice, perfect in his generations. What does that mean? It could be that his pedigree didn't include the perversions that were going on in the world, the demonic activity that was occurring. That's why he was perfect in his generations. We're also told Noah walked with God. Noah was a man who loved God, a man who desired intimacy with God. Hebrews 11, verse 7 also describes Noah as a man of faith. Verse 10, "And Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth." These four men, along with their wives, Noah and his family, are the nucleus from which God will start over with man and repopulate the earth after the flood. One other interesting point. Of the 10 men mentioned in Genesis chapter 5, from Adam down to Noah, all but Noah was a contemporary of Adam. Remember, the first man lived to be 930 years old. He didn't die until Noah's dad, Lamech, was 56 years old. And thus, the creation story didn't need to be passed down from mouth to mouth to mouth to mouth over hundreds of generations. Rather, only three communications were needed: from God to Adam, from Adam to Lamech, and then from Lamech to his grandson Shem. Just three people linked the story of creation from the beginning to the post-flood world after the flood. Which is very interesting. Verse 11, "The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence." You remember the boast of the other Lamech, Cain's kid? who killed a man and then boasted to his wives that I'll give vengeance 77-fold. That was just one example of the extreme violence that existed in that day. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. Wickedness, perversion were rampant, and God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Verse 14, make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms, or literally cubicles, in the ark, and cover it inside and outside with pitch, which made it waterproof. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. Now, a cubit was the distance from the king's elbow to the tips of his fingers. The Hebrews usually judged the cubit as about 18 inches. And so if we're using 18 inches as a cubit, that would mean that the ark measured 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. God's instructions continue in verse 16. You shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it to a cubit from above and set the door of the ark in its side. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. It's interesting that prior to 1858, Noah's Ark was the largest seagoing vessel ever constructed. Its three decks would provide over 100,000 square feet of floor space. To illustrate its capacity, imagine sitting at a railroad crossing, watching a train pass by in front of you, a train that had 522 livestock cars, each car packed with 240 sheep. That's the ark's capacity, 125,280 sheep. Bah, that's not bad. And its 6-to-1 length-to-width ratio is, by modern-day shipbuilding standards, the perfect proportion to survive rough waters. It's amazing. The ark would have never capsized. The ark was also constructed with a window at the top, 18 inches high, and many scholars believe it ran the whole length of the ark, whole length of the ship, providing fresh air and ventilation for the people inside. And they needed fresh air and ventilation inside the ark, because you can bet it did stink. That's why it's been said, the church is like Noah's ark. At times it may stink inside, but it still beats the alternative. And yes, it does. You'll find that the church is far from a perfect place. At times, stinky stuff happens. But you know, God's church remains His alternative to this wicked world. Ride it out. You'll be safe from the storm. In verse 17, God says, behold, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die. Note, this is not a local flood. This is a worldwide flood. And there is tremendous evidence for a universal flood. Did you know that some of the world's tallest mountain peaks, the Himalayas, for example, are made of sedimentary rock? Sediments that were laid down by water? When were the Himalayas underwater? We've also found marine fossils on the peaks of some of the world's tallest mountains. Marine fossils. And understand, a global deluge is the most validated event in antiquity. All cultures, Mexican, Middle Eastern, Chinese, even the American Indians have accounts of a great flood and a boat and a family who survived. Though the stories are not identical to the biblical record and obviously corrupted versions of that record, nevertheless, they testify to the same historical event, a global flood.
Listening to Bible teaching here on the radio is a huge blessing that many of our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world simply don't have. We rejoice in this opportunity to share Pastor Sandy's messages with you. We do want to be sure to remind you that radio is not a church. Radio should be a complement to what God is already doing in your personal discipleship through the local body of believers that you're a part of. Maybe you're listening today. You don't have a home church. You've visited various places, but nothing seems to fit. First, if you live in the Atlanta, Georgia area, we want to personally invite you to join us for worship at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain. We meet every Sunday morning at 9:30 and 11:15 a.m. For more information, including driving directions, please log on to sandyadams.org and follow the link to the church website. Now, if you're listening outside of the Atlanta, Georgia area and are looking for a home church, we encourage you to log on to calvarychapel.com and find a Calvary Chapel in your area that teaches through the Bible just like Pastor Sandy does each day here on this program. Well, we wish we had more time today, but we've come to the close of today's broadcast. Be sure to remember to join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through God's Word. That's next time on Sandy Adams Radio.